Hello, everybody. My name is Ray. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Today, we're going to dive into the Antioch Declaration. It's not a statement because they're not saying it. They're declaring it. And Doug Wilson, James White, and Joe Boot, the primary authors of this, or collaborators, their words, of this document, they should be embarrassed that they put this out. It is sloppy. It is liberal. It is woke. And it needs to be called out. And we got to prevent this statement from being accepted, because this statement, if accepted, could be used as a test of orthodoxy or ordination. So it is very important that this statement just be resoundingly rejected by the church at large, because it is that bad. It is sloppy. It is poorly written. And nobody would know what this is talking about unless they were drilled on years of internet debate and beef, because that is how obscure this statement is. It is not responding to a legitimate issue facing the church, and instead is trying to struggle session the church for being more right-wing than people like Doug Wilson, James White, or Joe Boot. So let's dive into this, but first I want you to know Evangelical Dark Web is a Christian news gathering and commentary ministry. You can support our work over at our Patreon-like system at evangelicaldarkweb.org/join. Link in the description below. The least you can do is like this video, subscribe to the channel, to the podcast if you're new. Best way to help out with those magical YouTube algorithms is new subscribers. Also check out Winning Not Winsome, my book. Now, this Antioch Declaration goes against pretty much what I've written in Winning Not Winsome, because it is trying to leverage a proxy issue that is not based on a primary issue. So I talk about this in chapter one. Then I have a chapter on attacking things that need to be destroyed. This whole Antioch Declaration is attacking what does not need to be destroyed. And for that issue, for that reason, it causes unnecessary division. So I could go on, but you should get the book. Check it out. Linked in the description below. And let's dive into the Antioch Declaration. I wrote an article for Sunday. The Antioch Declaration, a statement on racial ideologies threatening the church. Now, this, again, that is a very woke framing of the issue, but wait until you read the first paragraph, which says, just as the Apostle Paul at Antioch opposed him, Peter, to his face because he stood condemned for compromising the gospel of Jesus Christ by subjecting it to racial barriers, so this brief statement opposes the ideas of some contemporary leaders and influencers seeking to introduce anti-gospel racial categories into the church. And then it claims that this was not developed in haste, but after much prayer, thought, counsel, and soul-searching. Again, I don't think that's a very accurate statement. Neither is this next paragraph, which talks about a broad range of churches. They added Lutheran and evangelical believers because the authors of this are not from a broad range of churches. You got Joe Boot, Ezra Institute, and I believe Andrew Sandlin and Tobias Reimenschneider are also part of that. More on him later. Jeff Durbin and James White, part of Apologia Church, and then Doug Wilson. So clearly it's a very small, narrow camp of people that wrote this document. It's not fairly representative of Lutheran or evangelical believers from a broad range of churches. It's actually a pretty narrow range of churches. The biggest separating factor is baptism. But other than that, if you take out the baptism issue, like, how different are these churches? Anyway, I wrote an article about this that I kind of want to use to guide my video to keep it shorter and more concise. So they are LARPing as Antioch, which is actually my second critique of this document. They are LARPing as Antioch. They're trying to appeal to the city from antiquity and also the Middle Ages. I didn't think James White was a fan of the Crusades, and Antioch played a very critical role in the First Crusades, by the way. And nevertheless, they are trying to The titular location in the statement is an appeal to credibility that the statement otherwise would lack if it was named after some obscure town in the United States, or, you know, even Germany or wherever Joe Boot is from. I think I can't remember whether it's the UK or Canada. But anyway, there it's a false appeal to the Bible. Just, you know, they're using Paul at Antioch. Now, this is a misreading of the text. It is very bad exegesis, what they did there. And it's very bad in a very woke way. They're trying to impose social justice on to the text. The Judaizers in the New Testament were not introducing anti-racial gospel categories. They were introducing law on top of the gospel. Key difference. They had a very woke reading of that text. The Hellenistic Jews were uncircumcised, so therefore these ethnic Jews were also subject to the wrath of the Judaizers. This makes, again, this is rather woke language, as Jesus often spoke in racial categories about his mission or to make a point about unbelief. But Christ could hardly be called anti-gospel. So, again, when Jesus is talking to the Syro-Phoenician woman, who's a Canaanite, by the way, when he's talking to the woman at the well, who's a Samaritan, by the way, when he heals the servant of the centurion, who's a Roman, by the way, he interacts with Gentiles. But these interactions are quite notable. And Jesus does this, and I think the text includes this, to highlight the unbelief of the Jews. But Jesus makes it very clear he came to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, which referred to the ethnic Israel at that time. So that's very evident in the mission of Christ. And we have to remember that. He did come to his people first, and they rejected him. So this is all integral to the story. Jesus' mission had racial barriers. But anyway, bad exegesis on the text leads to very woke conclusions. So let's talk about the slander and the hypocrisy undergirding the text before we get into the actual declaration itself, because we're just in the opening, the introduction. So in the background of this declaration is a scandal of Tobias Reimann-Schneider, who was one of the six collaborators on the document. Again, their words. Reimann-Schneider slandered Joel Webbin in a failed attempt to discredit his entire ministry. I did a live stream on this. AD Robles has done a lot of videos on this, it seems. And again, as Robles points out, he was throwing haymakers to end Joel Webbin's career. He was trying to end his ministry, discredit him permanently. And I don't think he acted on this alone. And it coincidentally appears that the collaborators, Doug Wilson, James White, and Joe Boot, Jeff Durbin, and Andrew Sandlin, who I'm not familiar with, they are all seemingly involved in Tobias's slander. They're kind of involved. And he did make reference to how big names were backing his bid to do this. Now, I do want to highlight that later in the document, it says, "We deny that it is possible to be a faithful Christian shepherd without identifying, naming, and fighting the wolves which prey on the flock. As such, pastors have a duty to confront and rebuke woke wickedness in all its forms within their congregation." So obviously, the wickedness of slander is being overlooked. And Joe Boot's Ezra Institute did release a statement on Friday night overlooking some slander. They were overlooking some slander over there at the Ezra Institute. And I'm going to call that out as well. So some things they do, they're not willing to overlook, but slander against another pastor, they will. And I do have a chapter on naming names, and they don't do that in this document. And it's clear that because they're talking about false shepherds in this entire statement, it's pretty much going after Joel Webbin and the people from Ogden, Utah. It's pretty disgraceful what they're doing here, is making an entire statement just to go after their competition, really. So let's talk about the first statement in the declaration, because it's not a statement, but these are all statements. It says, "We deny that the kingdom purposes of Christ and requirements of his word can be equated with the seating positions of political actors during the French Revolution, or that the modern antithesis between right and left is equivalent to the antithesis that God established in the Garden of Eden between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of light. Man, is that a mouthful. This statement is a terrible way to open up. Instead of appealing to historic Christian creeds, reiterating the gospel, or establishing the need for the declaration, which is unclear to the normie, because again, someone who's not steeped in theobro discourse is not going to understand this statement. They don't understand the need for it. It's embarrassing on that front because it's so confusing. The statement begins with Wilson-style prose, and I'm not opposed to Wilson-style prose, but in a synodical declaration, it is definitely not befitting of the occasion. And a Tim Keller-level third wayism, because that's what that was. It was saying, the right isn't right, the left isn't right. There's a third way that is correct, is the underlying implication of that first statement in the declaration. So it was a Tim Kellerism. That is what was going on there, which again, Tim Keller was extremely woke. So essentially they're arguing that neither left nor right has the gospel, which has only been the message of many liberals for several years now. However, the Antioch statement is about denouncing Christians who are more right-wing than its authors, and that is what this is really about. And that opening statement, very terrible way to set up this entire thing. So one of the hilarious misfires is that this statement affirms, then denies the post-war consensus, which is a broad category, and I'm just going to oversimplify it, a liberal secularism that became dominant as a result of the Second World War, which, again, an oversimplification. The Antioch Declaration denies it by attributing it to an earlier event. The statement says, quote, we deny that neo-pagan secularism with its utopian religious motive arose out of the arose as a consensus after World War II. Rather, it manifests itself as a political outworking of the so-called Enlightenment during the French Revolution and gradually won the hearts and minds of Western nations, being well expressed in the political philosophies dominating Europe prior to the outbreak of the two global conflagrations. One thing that I do note, I said this in the other Paul live stream, you need a dictionary to read this. Just a heads up, if you're going to read this, you might need a dictionary. I had never seen the word adiaphora before this declaration. Maybe I'm not as well read. But again, using big words that aren't stained glass theological words, not a very good idea for this type of document. So this is a bad argument because the World Wars eliminated alternative views that were pervasive in Europe for several centuries in favor of either Marxism or liberalism. Ideologies such as monarchism, fascism, national socialism, republicanism, and autocracy were rejected in favor of democracy. So again, this is part of the post-war consensus. Why did it become a consensus? Because the other alternatives were wiped out. Now, I'm not endorsing all the other alternatives or any of them for the purposes of this argument. I'm just saying what was wiped out. The First World War wiped out a lot of European monarchical systems and prestige. And some people try to frame it as a war between democracy and monarchy. So with that said, when did these ideas of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution become the consensus? The answer is after World War II. That is when they became a consensus, because they eliminated through means of war other governing alternatives. So this is a massive difference that the Antioch Declaration is too sloppy to understand. And then in the next one, they say, we affirm that the aftermath of World War II served as a cultural tipping point for the secular narrative and its myth of religious neutrality, which has functioned as a centerpiece for these lies. It has promoted this deception with triumphal hubris throughout all Western institutions, insisting on both idolatrous religious pluralism and a mandatory globalist cosmopolitan. Man, so these arose after World War II. It served as a tipping point for when this became a consensus. So they just denied the post-war consensus exists, and then they just affirmed that it exists. And then as a bonus, I'm going to talk about this. It says, we affirm that that a contradictory and pervasive thread of self-doubt and self-loathing has also formed an essential part of this secular narrative following the horrors of World War II. Thus, when the reactionary right challenges the post-war consensus, they are not necessarily breaking free of it. This is a right reflex that the post-war narrative itself has nurtured. This narrative thrives on an unstable mix of white imperiousness and white guilt. Again, this is that James Lindsay level argument of a dialectical trap where everything's a Hegelian dialogue, even though James Lindsay represents the synthesis. This represents the synthesis in the Hegelian dialect. And again, I'm not big on Hegel. I don't really care about philosophy in general. We'll get to Aristotle at the end, though, because that's one of the last things I want to talk about. But this is a pathetic argument. It essentially says you can't beat the post-war consensus unless you do X, Y, Z the exact right way. It's a James Lindsay level argument. It is horrendous because James Lindsay is, after all, Hal James Lindsay, the false prophet of Pride Month. So you listen to him, you won't accomplish anything. And I think Christians should be winning, not win some. We should win all, not some. So that's what I believe. So let's talk about the condemnation of noticing. So for some reason, the Antioch Statement is obsessed with relitigating World War II, thus highlighting the vanity of going through the effort to make this statement. In a stunning and brave moment, the statement denounces Adolf Hitler. Just so stunning, so brave. They should get all the medals at the NCAAP event, or NAACP event, whatever, or the GLAAD event, or the ADL event, for denouncing Adolf Hitler. They deserve all the New York Times columns for doing this. So stunning, so brave. More importantly, though, the Antioch Declaration goes after Christians for noticing, condemning many spiritual fathers in the church. It says, we affirm that in deeply unsettled times, there is a carnal desire in fallen men to seek out a scapegoat for sin and social corruption. This sadistic urge to expiate guilt by laying the blame and punishment for all cultural ills on an identifiable group or groups, the victimized group or groups, is offered up to the masses as providing ostensible explanatory power for cultural decay, which all conspiracy theories must provide if they are to gain any traction. First of all, not true about conspiracy theories. And let me finish, though. The Jews have also often been the easiest target for this kind of sinful and decrepit thinking. Now, again, this is a straw man argument, but it's also just historically fallacious. A deep dive into the history of the Jews in various nations. We can do Rome, Russia, Spain, and England. I don't want to talk about Germany at the moment. Does showcase a pattern of behavior that is not tantamount to an innocent victim narrative. Winston Churchill's observations about the Jews in the 1920s were not all that dissimilar from Adolf Hitler's. What? I thought Winston Churchill was the hero, right? He had the same views as Hitler on this subject? Well, he had different solutions, though. But he identified the same problem. Nevertheless, it embeds the woke victimhood narrative that Jews are collective victims in societies that have thought to expel them or something like that. And that's not historically accurate. The statement goes on to say, I don't believe this is consecutive, by the way. So I'm skipping a few lines here. We deny that Jews are in any way uniquely malevolent or sinful, that Judaism in its multifarious expressions is objectively more dangerous than any other false religions, or that it represents an exceptional threat to Christianity and Christian peoples. By nature, the Jews are objects of wrath, just like the rest of us, which Is condemnation enough and are equally recipients of God's grace? Now, that last part's not very Calvinist for all you Reformed bros that made this document, but nevertheless, let's first note that the statement switches from viewing Jews as a religious group to an ethnic group, which is sloppy. Now, again, when people like me use Jews, what we're really meaning is ethnic or cultural Jews that are not Christian. Pretty broad, but very accurate usage of the word in our context for our purposes. We're saying not Christian. It doesn't matter whether they're super religious or super atheistic. We're using it to say not Christian. But they switch from using it as an ethnic categorization to a religious categorization in one sentence to the next. That's just bad writing. So let's move on from that. But it is worth highlighting. Moreover, this statement is either equating all false religions or stating that Judaism is more innocuous than other false religions. Dealing with the former, all religions that have not Christ result in damnation. Pretty agreeable. All Christians believe in the exclusivity of Christ. However, not all false religions are equal in their threat to Christians. This is a nonsensical proposition. Islam is likely the number one threat to Christianity and a claim that is difficult to argue against. Let's grant the claim because I don't feel like making the argument against that claim because there's, 1,400 years that show that Islam and Christianity really don't get along. And Islam has often had the military upper hand in these situations. So, what this statement is saying is that in a power rankings of false religions, threat to Christianity, Judaism cannot be ranked higher than any other religions, which is nonsensical. This statement condemns ranking Judaism second behind Islam, which is a historically fair placement. If you were to say, what is the number two threat to Christians? Which religion threatens Christians the second most in church history? I think Judaism's definitely number two. There's a lot of even 20th century evidence to that end, as well as 21st century as well. So, the statement forbids power rankings in such historical debates like I think are worth entertaining. But let's do a sinful partiality test. We deny that Muslims are in any way uniquely malevolent or sinful, that should have said Islam, in its multifarious expressions is objectively more dangerous than other false religions, or that it represents an exceptional threat to Christianity or Christian peoples. By nature, the Muslims are objects of wrath, just like the rest of us, which is condemnation enough, and are equally recipients of God's grace. Now again, Christians would rightly ridicule that statement. Undergirding this discrepancy is the fact that many Christians incidentally believe the heresy that Jews worship the same God as we do. They do not. Again, any religion that does not have Christ does not have the Father either. This is an errant belief that has led to a misplaced partiality and sense of alignment and greatest allyship. The statement goes on to say, we deny that world affairs are governed by conspiring Jews or that there is a global Jewish conspiracy theory to corrupt and destroy Western society. Let's consider how untrue the statement is when applied to Islam. We deny that world affairs are governed by conspiring Muslims or that there is a global Islamic conspiracy to corrupt and destroy Western civilization. This assumes a simplified and secular view of conspiracies. Again, I'm a bit of a conspiracy theorist at times. I do a lot of media stuff. But ultimately, it's not the people that are doing the plans. I'm not a huge believer in free will, by the way. It's Satan ultimately guiding a lot of the schemes of men. They're not as free in their will as they think they are to choose their own destiny and their own path and the outcomes for their own actions. They don't get to choose the consequences for what they do. Ultimately, that's in the hand of God. So, I believe that pagan religions are guided by Satan, who doth conspires against God and his elect. Pretty biblical statement, by the way. Now, this can easily be said of Jews, too. I mean, I think Muslims are conspiring in some ways. The invasion of Europe, we can talk about that. But now this can easily be said of the Jews also. The Democrat Party is functionally a Jewish party. And then I list a whole lot of leaders in the Democrat Party that are Jewish. The most significant members of the Biden cabinet. Kamala Harris's husband, a Supreme Court justice. They used to have two Supreme Court justices. And Merrick Garland is actively persecuting believers. So anyway, let's talk about how Mormons are the real threat. Recognizing that pagans govern wickedly is what people who have eyes to see notice. The church would be edified by a declaration that denounced the Democrat Party, but instead we are treated with denunciations of the Third Reich, which boldly go where many have gone before. This was the portion of the statement that the statement most wanted to establish. So this was the most. And this is only the second most illogical. And I kind of say that denouncing Aristotle is the most illogical. If you were unaware, let's talk about Aristotle. If you were unaware of Christians being led astray, worshiping Aristotle as the model man, the Antioch Declaration is here to inform you on the issue. We affirm, this is a quote, we affirm that in all things, including the treatment of our fellow human beings, the model man, an example is not the life and teaching of Aristotle, nor any other merely historical personage, but the Lord Jesus Christ himself, the Son of Man and eternal Son of God. This statement ends with an attack on Aristotle, which seemingly came from James White, although Joe Boot is also very much into Vantillian apologetics. The affirmation responds to a non-issue with a truism fallacy. This section is embarrassing to have included. So those are my biggest criticisms, the biggest embarrassments in this statement. The statement will get astroturfed, but the internet has soundly rejected its merits. Again, I could have talked about its literary reference to Rusty Reno, which does not have a footnote. I could have talked about their nonsensical claim about the broad range of believers who crafted the statement. Actually, I did talk about that in this video. And then they later edited it. So they did edit the opening statement, the introduction to it. But anyway, there's a lot that's wrong with this statement. They should be embarrassed that they put it out. And I'm here to shine some light on that because this statement needs to fail. It's best for the church that this statement fail. And that's all I got to say about that for now. My name's Ray, it's the Evangelical Dark Web. If you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the channel, to the podcast. If you're new, have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.